bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree.
We are talking about apples on the show today to begin the probably the first 90 minutes of the show with a couple of guests. But our first guest wrote the book titled The Light Between Apple Trees. She is Priyanka Kumar, and she also wrote Conversations with Birds, among other things. She was the Leopold Writing Program's Aldo and Estella Leopold resident for August of 2020, if I'm not mistaken. She now serves on the advisory council for that program. And she's written a dandy book, and it'll be fun talking with her about apples and her experiences with them. And as we talk with Priyanka, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about the apples you enjoy. How does picking and growing apples make you feel connected with nature? Do you ever forage for wild apples? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Priyanka Kumar, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. Give us some insight to begin with on the book's title, The Light Between Apple Trees.
Right. Well, early on while researching the book, I heard about an orchard, the Rial Orchard, which is one of the oldest in the area that I live in, and I really wanted to get in there. But the orchard is owned by a federal agency, BLM, Bureau of Land Management. And so I needed to find somebody who worked there and could open the locked codes and get me in. And so I finally made that happen one fine October morning. And we got into this orchard, and it was pretty weedy. There were a lot of fields, and it was raining, which is unusual in New Mexico. So we bushwhacked our way through these fields, trying to avoid stepping on a 7-foot rattlesnake. I mean, this place is known for its rattlesnakes. And so amidst all of that drama, then we, you know, hopped over an acequia, which is like an irrigation ditch, and then came to this glorious line of about 7 or 8 apple trees that were heavy with fruit. And I had left my water bottle behind, and I was thirsty, and I just kind of reached over and grabbed an apple. And it just, you know, standing there, I looked up, eating the apple, and I saw this line of ancient basalt hills, and I happen to know that they're rich in petroglyphs. And the sun was shining on me through these apple trees, and I suddenly, Larry, I felt at home. I felt like this is where I wanted to be. And it brought me back to my childhood, honestly. And I in a sense, the book is a journey unpacking why I feel so much at home in these old orchards.
And your interest, I mean, you've been enchanted by apples since you were a young kid, 5 years old or so.
Yeah, even going back to when I was 2 years old, and back then, so I was incredibly fortunate. For the first roughly 10 years of my life, I lived in the foothills of the Himalayas. I was born in the eastern foothills, and then we moved to the northwestern foothills, to the heart of the apple-growing region in that area. So since I was a two-year-old, I was weaving through these mother apple trees, and I experienced them as living beings towering over me. And then when I was about 4 or 5, my dad took me to this magical apple orchard, and I spent the whole day there. And I feel like it was a really pivotal experience in my life. And I won't spoil it for readers, because I worked my way back to that important memory that I think was the seed that sprouted and you know, led to my becoming a lifelong naturalist.
Yeah.
But it was only later that I found out that some of these areas that I was freely roaming in, and I guess this was a time when parents still allowed their kids to roam, and now scientists know that The area where I grew up in is among the 18 most biodiverse hotspots on our planet. So as a little kid, I didn't know that, but I was entranced by the diversity of wildflowers, the diversity of fruit, and I was eating everything, even the flowers.
And you've tried to bring that along, as I see in the book. I mean, your children are they're out doing what you did kind of as a kid.
Yeah, and as you know, with conversations with birds, we were hiking a lot to look for birds, which we still do. And at some point, the kids started to resist a little bit, as kids are prone to do. And so it was somewhat fortunate that around that time, I began to rediscover my interest in the apple, because what I've learned is that you can always take kids along with you if your destination is, you know, a nice grove of fruit trees, and they'll climb the trees and pick the fruit for you too.
Well, you live in New Mexico, which, you know, if somebody would have said New Mexico has apple trees, I would have said, you know, we've got tons of apple trees here in Wisconsin. But I think a lot of people would be like me, to be kind of surprised to hear apples grow there well. And how you, and maybe talk about how you foraged for apples around your home.
I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, you don't necessarily think of New Mexico as an apple haven. You know, we have the Southwest has been in a drought for the last 20, 22 years. So there's that. We're in a mega drought. And it's a dry area to begin with. We're in the high desert. But what a lot of us forget is that there's this rich apple history in places like New Mexico, in the Southwest. So often when we're thinking about settlers bringing apple seeds to America, we think about perhaps settlers from England or maybe Ireland. But in fact, there's a rich history that I uncovered while writing the book of settlers from France and also Spain bringing apple seeds to the area. So in New Mexico particularly, we benefited from the Spanish bringing apple seeds and planting them as early as some of the areas that I ended up doing field work in, like the Manzano Mountains. And the mountains are named for, you know, Manzano, the Spanish word for apple tree. And they were planting apple trees there certainly by the early 1700s. So during the pandemic, especially when I think I upped my hiking and my walking game.
We all did.
Right, we all did, didn't we? I began to discover these fragments of nature that I hadn't realized existed closer to me than I might have suspected. And I think one of the key things I do in the book is I come up with this concept of the microwild. And so one of the first microwilds that really impacted me was a place where I stumbled upon a private apple orchard. And not only that, but I began to see signs that a bear, and I started to call her Ursula, was coming to this apple orchard to, you know, get some sustenance. And I would see little circles of bear fur where then she would, you know, satiate it with apples. She would take a little nap. So I found it incredible that a fragment of nature could harbor such biodiversity, could support wild creatures, everything from a hummingbird to a bear. And I started to wonder, well, is it possible that there are wild or feral apple trees growing here? And so I started to hike more deeply in that area. And as I write about in the book, one of my thrilling discoveries was when I discovered that, yes, indeed, there were apple trees that had been planted here, perhaps by bears. And they were pretty darn good. They weren't spitters, I'll say. they were a good refreshment on a hot sunny day when you were hiking. So that was key. And I became really enchanted with feral apple trees and began to wonder, are there more microwilds around us? Because these are these are truly jewel-like places where people like you and me, you know, we may not have access to the true wilderness every weekend of our lives, but we have access to these microwilds. So this is where we can renew our connection to nature and really experience almost the way that an ecosystem works and sustains biodiversity.
One of the goals, frankly, of actually, I should say, of your Apple journey is something you call rewilding. What does that mean?
Yeah, so because these microwilds are such jewel-like places where we can get reconnected to nature, and they're also close to where we live, because of all of these good things, they are also under incredible development pressures. So I think it's so important that we acknowledge their value and that we figure out ways of conserving these places. But in addition to that, I believe that we can begin this process of rewilding, growing a variety of native trees and also a variety of apple trees in our own backyards. And this is something that I began to do. And I'll be honest with you, my first efforts met with complete and utter failure. And it's partly because we were trying to conserve water at the same time. Feed our apple trees with recycled kitchen water, and that just wasn't enough. And so we tried all over again, and now, you know, we have about 15 different varieties of trees that we're growing, and so it's just such a beautiful thing. I mean, I just harvested my Newtown Pippin apples, and this is an apple variety from one of the oldest apple varieties in the country, going back to 1750. And so while harvesting the apples, I was able to tell my little daughter about, you know, the history, about the fact that, Thomas Jefferson liked to brag about this apple. And when he went to Paris, he wrote a letter back saying that they don't have apples here like the Newtown Pippin. And then, you know, you can always trust Benjamin Franklin to make something of a good thing. So he decided, well, I think we should export Newtown Pippins to England. And because Newtown Pippins, they're not great lookers, I'd say, but they're great keepers. And in a time before refrigeration, you really needed apples to be able to keep well while they were being shipped for long days. And lo and behold, it became a smash hit in England, and Queen Victoria herself became a devotee. So I was able to bring all of this history to life for my kid just through, you know, the act of growing the Newtown Pippin and harvesting the fruit with her.
Oh, man. Priyanka Kumar, our guest today, she is the author of The Light Between Apple Trees. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. We're taking a look at apples on the show today with our guest, Priyanka Kumar. She is the author of the book, The Light Between Apple Trees. We'll be continuing that at 11:45. Wisconsin apple expert Dan Bussey will be on the show as well, and he'll talk about growing and eating apples right here in our state. He's done a lot of work on that. And it'll be fun talking with him as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You mentioned Benjamin Franklin, but you as part of the book or maybe your own interest, you visited Thomas Jefferson's home to learn about the apples that he grew. And that was a time when there were thousands or more of apple varieties being grown in the state, in the country.
Yeah, that's right. There was, you know, we have a history of almost having, I would say, like an intense love affair with apples. In states like Virginia, there was an amazing apple culture. So for a month, I was a fellow at the Center for Historic Plants, and I researched in addition to some historic Virginia orchards, I also especially researched Jefferson's South and North orchards, where at one point he was growing a staggering 170 varieties of fruit trees. So, and of course, I did struggle with the fact that he was, using slave labor to power his orchards. At the same time, I was researching and trying to get a window into the American apple culture at the time. And one of the things that most impressed me is that not only were a lot of the founding fathers growing apples, I mean, you have George Washington and also especially John Adams, but they were corresponding about apples and they were writing each other these passionate notes about the varieties that they loved. And Jefferson was literally sending boxes of plants and trees to Paris to his friends. So this was, you know, something that was a big part of people's everyday lives. So it wasn't just gentlemen farmers, you know, growing a few fruit trees, but they were really passionate about this. And one of the things that really touched me while I was in Charlottesville is that an orchard there harvested some of the Hughes crab apples that Jefferson had originally been growing, and began to distill cider from those. And they made this award-winning cider that I think won the governor's cup. And they were so excited about this and wanted me to taste the cider, and it was absolutely wonderful. So, you know, being there for a month researching apples, I also came across people where, you know, obviously we might have differences in the way we think about political issues, but I found that we could always get together and talk about apples and get excited about apples, the kinds, the varieties that we loved, and feel a little bit of a taste of that old apple culture. So I began to develop these apple friendships that, you know, I still hold on to today. So that was kind of like an unexpected benefit. Joy that came out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned crab apples, and we can go way back in the history. And crab apples, I think you report or note that played an important role in the development of apples way back. I mean, way back.
That's right. Yeah. I like to think that in the book, I take readers through something of a scientific roller coaster to tell the true story of the apple. And we're only learning the true story in the last 20 years. So for well over 200 years, scientists believed that the primary ancestor of the cultivar apple that we eat today, this is Malus domestica, was the wild Kazakh apple, Malus siversi, which still grows on the flanks of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan. And so everything pointed, all the morphological studies pointed to this being the primary ancestor. But around 200 years back, there was a German scientist who asked a question about, well, what about the wild European crab apple? Did that have a role to play? And back then, that was considered to be the equivalent in scientific circles of dropping a bomb. And everybody was like, no, there's no way, you know, not the wild European crab apple. But guess what? In just the last 20 years, the newest genetic studies are showing us that, yes, indeed, the wild European crab apple did have a very significant role to play in siring the apple that we eat today. So one of the things that happened is that during the Silk Route, early on during that time period, the apple, the wild Kazakh apple, began to travel both eastward to China and westward to Europe. And of course, when it was traveling through Europe, what happened? This kind of bitter, savory wild apple hybridized with the small, sour, wild European crab apple. And lo and behold, we got something like the cultivar apple that we eat today. Now, of course, that apple eventually made its way to America. It's such a transnational fruit. I feel like when I hold the apple in my hand, I feel like, there's this electric charge almost, a sense of adventure. And then it comes here to America, where settlers are planting all these apple seeds. And America, of course, becomes kind of a laboratory for new varieties. And when you plant an apple seed, most likely you'll get a spitter. You're not going to get the apple variety that you covet. But sometimes you get a wonderful variety, and that did happen here, which, you know, goes on to explain why Americans eventually were growing more than 10,000 apple varieties. I just find it to be incredible.
It is indeed. You mentioned Jean-Baptiste Lamy. Yeah, earlier, and when we're thinking about how did apples get around, he was kind of, I think you say, kind of a lesser-known Johnny Appleseed. And I found his story, and also Jesus Garcia much later, obviously. Talk about Lamy.
Lamy is a very interesting figure. He was a French missionary who grew up in a region in France where fruit growing was very important. So he, as a child, I'd like to think that he internalized the value of fruit growing. And he left for America when he was quite young still, probably around 21. And that's when he first came here as a missionary. He was very keen on coming here and spreading not only his faith, but something that he didn't talk about a lot, also spreading his great love of fruit culture. So he first settled in places like Ohio and eventually made his way to Santa Fe, where I live today, and began dreaming of making this beautiful cathedral that Willa Cather immortalizes his dream in that wonderful novel, Death Comes to the Archbishop. And so he made that cathedral, but the cathedral is what a lot of us talk about. But what we don't know about is that he also created this gem of a garden around the cathedral with many, many fruit trees. And he came to Santa Fe at a time when there weren't a lot of trees here, but he believed in crisscrossing the country by train and gathering seeds and saplings wherever he could and bringing them back here. And that's primarily what he gave to people as gifts. He would actually plant trees for them as gifts. I mean, he was this amazing person with a prescient ecological vision. I mean, this is at a time when the word ecology wasn't yet coined, but I think he believed that he, with his own hands, could create this garden of fruit trees and really demonstrate. I think it was like a demonstration garden. He could demonstrate what can be done with the land if we actually, you know, get our hands into the soil. So he had a great impact in this area, and he was bringing, you know, I mean, locally, we still talk about how big his peaches and apples were, and his strawberries. And what's interesting to me is that he built this treasure of a garden, and then after his death,
kind of went to pod.
Yeah, I mean, it's like his ecological vision wasn't really recognized by the church, and eventually the land was just kind of sold off, filled up, asphalted over, and it's a parking lot today. And I mean, it's so depressing when you look at the photos and see what glory he created to see that, all of that is just a parking lot today. I think it says a lot. It speaks to how we've forgotten some very important things. That forgetting is one of the things that may have landed us in the kind of trouble that we are in today.
Yeah. Well, there are people out there who are still at work creating community, as you talk about in the book. One of the people that I was intrigued by was Jesus Garcia, and his grafting work. Talk about him. And he was working out of, I'm trying to remember where he was working out of. Wasn't it Tucson, Arizona?
Yeah, the Tucson Mission Gardens. And yeah, I found him to be an inspirational figure. And I think, you know, one reason I included him in the book is because he shows us a pathway to what can still be done today. So, you know, we may be stuck with these parking lots, but it's still possible to get the asphalt removed, you know, as I've done around my own property. But what Jesus did is that he began to go to these old homesteads, old sites, you know, backs of churches, and began to find limbs of apple trees that he could then graft to healthy rootstock. And, you know, this work was supported by the Kino Heritage Fruit Project. And there's some good people in Tucson supporting this work. And he brought back, you know, all of these grafts and put together a whole array of new apple trees and other fruit trees. And one of the things that interested me, it was just a coincidence, but a meaningful coincidence, that at least while I was there, they ended up they were growing about 170 varieties of fruit trees, which, you know, is about the same that Jefferson was doing. So it's almost, it's inspirational in the sense that it's a nod to the past, and it shows what the possibilities are, and that some of those old varieties, thankfully, are still there and are waiting for us to go and bring them back to life. And it's still possible to do that today.
You note in one chapter, maybe it was the same chapter, I think, a University of Wisconsin conference in Madison, Wisconsin, that the note was that 9 out of 10 varieties historically grown in the U.S. are at risk of falling out of production and falling off our own tables.
That's right. And as you know, Larry, Dan Bussey has done this wonderful work of cataloging some of these apple varieties, and there are over 16,000 named varieties of apples, which is just incredible. And sadly, scarcely a fifth of those varieties are accessible to us today. So in reality, what happens is that when a person goes to a grocery store, they may see about, you know, 5 or 6 varieties, and they never really get to tap into the incredible richness of apple varieties, not just with regards to taste, but I think with regards to their historic stories, like I was describing with the Newtown Pippin. And so I think one of the things that's important that all of us do, and it's such an easy thing to do, and it's just a way to begin to walk on this path, is to get to know our local orchardists. Because they're people around us, they're caretakers of apple trees who are doing such wonderful work. And, you know, so we start buying our apples from our local orchardists and our farmers markets, where there may be an orchardist who's selling 10 varieties of apples, and they're very proud to do this. So it's so important that we support them and we talk to them and have those conversations and really get to know some of these varieties, like the Jonathan apple, for instance, which is like this red ball-like apple. It's being called the essence of the American apple. And recently I was acquiring a crate of Jonathans from an orchardist in Chimayu, and he got so excited and he said, you know, they're just the best. And then pretty soon we were talking about, you know, other old varieties like the Maiden's Blush and the Rome Beauty, which he still grows. And he was just so happy that there was a person there who was actually talking apple varieties with him. And at the end of the conversation, you know, he's this ancient guy. He put his hand out and shook his hand with me, and I took it to be a compliment. Such an enriching experience. And I would encourage listeners to, you know, just go for that and find that wherever you're living.
We have someone here who works at Wisconsin Public Radio who has a wonderful orchard just a small orchard, but there are many, many varieties, and it's really fun to go there. And you can, you know, if you ask, you can have a taste of an apple you never heard of. And there's a few that I've wound up purchasing that I didn't know existed, but I loved the taste. It's really, you're absolutely right about that. We had mentioned grafting and Jesus Garcia earlier. Grafting, I was really surprised to learn that grafting goes way, way back.
I mean, it really does have an ancient history. And what's interesting, especially in the Mediterranean regions, what's interesting to me is that for almost 200 years, American farmers were deeply suspicious of grafting. And they thought that, you know, to take the limb of one tree and then glue it to the rootstock of another tree, I mean, it seemed like an almost like a devilish act. And Johnny Appleseed himself didn't believe in grafting. And
Thoreau didn't like the taste of the apples from grafted trees, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's right. He had a fondness for feral trees, as I do myself. And it must be said that when you are out there hiking for a while, you know, and you come upon a feral tree, it truly is an exhilarating experience to eat from it. And it may not be the best apple variety, but it tastes really good outside. And but, you know, in early America, it didn't matter so much, I think, that people weren't grafting, because the apple wasn't primarily being used as a fruit that was being eaten. It was being grown to make cider. And you know, cider, it was almost safer to drink cider because the water was so brackish back then. So really, our early American culture was a cider culture rather than an eating apple culture. You can still grow spitters and make cider out of it. So so it seemed to have not harmed our apple culture that they didn't believe in grafting, but by and by, they came around.
Well, apples, I remember you writing somewhere that kids would have a glass of apple cider before they went off to school.
Yeah, that's right. And not just that, but, you know, our founding father, John Adams, had a cider habit, and he wouldn't dream of starting his day without a gill of cider. And he believed very staunchly that it was a health-giving habit. And I think he was right. You know, today we're finding out all the flavonoids in apples and all the different ways that they support our health. But John Adams was so deeply into it that he was not only, he and his wife Abigail, I mean, there's an amazing love story there. Not only were they making their own cider, but they were growing their own apple trees. And he was experimenting with seaweed, putting seaweed in his compost pile, and then using a hired worker to spread it in his meadow and, you know, nurturing his trees. I mean, it was his dream that one day a tree, you know, an apple tree grown by his hand would produce apples that his grandkids would be able to eat. So I find it really inspiring to know some of those stories. And I think that there's something that we can learn from them today.
You mentioned the Wolf River apple in the book. And actually, you contacted Dan Bussey, who will be with us next, about it.
And that was an amazing, amazing experience, because now I've been going to Las Golondrinas, the ranch of the swallows, for something like 17 years now here in New Mexico. And I was just there last weekend for the Harvest Festival, and I've been going every single year, sometimes many times a year. And, you know, being there and harvesting from their old, old apple trees was one of the experiences that I would say inspired the book. And at some point, one of the directors of the orchard gave me a tour of the trees that are not accessible to the public. And I asked him what variety some of these very old trees were. and he called them the wolf willow variety. And I came back home and looked at all the different apple databases that I had, and I couldn't find for the life of me an apple called a wolf willow. So I was very puzzled, and then I started looking at what the characteristics are of this apple. This is a large red apple with kind of a sandy crown, and it's a baking apple. It, you know, you could eat it, but it's a little tart, and it's the characteristics were awfully close to the characteristics of the Wolf River apple, which, you know, is a Wisconsin apple. So I got a little suspicious, and I got in touch with Dan Bussey, who very kindly, you know, confirmed my intuition that this Wolf Willow, so-called, was actually the Wolf River. And so I got very excited and began to delve deeper into the history of this apple. And it turns out that this variety was actually brought to Quebec by French settlers in the 1600s. And this also hit close to home because, you know, my husband, Michael, his maternal ancestry goes back, and they were French settlers who came to Quebec in the 1600s. So it's an illustration of how apples can really connect you to history. And at some point, a woodsman brought it down from Quebec to Wisconsin and planted it along the Wolf River in Wisconsin, perhaps in around 1856. I know it was seen growing there in 1875. So it has, you know, some really interesting history in Wisconsin that we could still explore. And at some point along the old Santa Fe Trail, it made its way down to New Mexico, and lo and behold.
Well, I have to tell you, Priyanka, that it's been a delight talking with you. And we haven't begun to cover everything that you have in your book that is so entertaining, informative. There's a strong sense of climate and climate change that we really haven't touched on like we probably should have. But I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed your book a lot. I'll probably give Dan Bussey a copy of it. He's giving me a thumbs up. He's right outside waiting to come in. Priyanka Kumar, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a joy. Thank you so much, Larry.
A real pleasure. Priyanka Kumar is the author of The Light Between Apple Trees, the subtitle, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. You're going to like the book. I'm pretty sure of that. And coming up, Dan Bussey. Who else to talk about Wisconsin apples? I'm Larry Neeler for WPR News. 100 times, hey-ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree. Makes you feel so fine, looking out across the orchard in the bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so